Welcome to Sales Talk for CEOs. I'm glad you're here. I'll be interviewing CEOs who have successfully scaled their B2B sales organization. In each episode, I'll start by uncovering the sales background of each CEO, dig into the strategies they use to build their sales organization, and wrap it up with what the future holds. We'll cover the good, the bad, and the ugly of scaling a sales organization. I'm your host, Alice Hyman. You start a company, things are going good, and you start to build a sales team. But then you need to change things up again and bring it back in so that you as a CEO are doing most of the selling. And then things change again. Each time monitoring your model to make sure it's working. This is what David did with Valence Global. And he's going to share with us how he has shaped his sales team, how he's grown his sales, and what's coming in the future. So welcome, David.
Thank you so much, Alice. It's a pleasure to join you.
I'm really glad you're here. We had such a great conversation off camera, and I know we're going to have a lot of things to talk about. So David Gartenstein Ross owns Valence Global, and he started this company, and he's doing some amazing things now for about the past 8 years, definitely impacting companies in the way that they prevent their any kind of security breach that might happen, looking at that. And then also he's worked with government agencies, including the Homeland Security, to draft. He was one of the lead drafters on the counterterrorism framework. So this is pretty important stuff. Tell us more about what your company does.
Thanks, Alice. The way I see Valence Global is as a company that is designed to both understand and craft laudable, innovative solutions to complex 21st century challenges. My background is in national security affairs and in international affairs. So that's a portfolio that sits toward the center of the company, but the kind of complex challenges that I'd like to be able to make a dent in are wide ranging and interlinked in very definable thematic ways. Usually they're problems that involve the intersection of evolving technologies, changing global society, often changing ecology or environment, and manifest in ways that are different as patterns than they were in the past. Disinformation, for example, is one such problem set. Problems involving climate change, problems involving terrorists and evolving technologies. Those are the problem sets that Valence is looking to tackle and has been able to do work on both with private institutions, with governments, and with universities and other educational institutions.
So important and challenging. And give us an idea of something that you've worked on, you know, of course, without revealing any names or such, that has been a pretty important project that you've been working on lately.
There's a lot of recent projects that I'm really fond of. To pick a few, one of the things that I've practices that we've scaled over the course of the past 2 years is our simulations and wargaming division.
Right.
And you know, war games don't necessarily have anything to do with war. They're games that are bounded by rules that are in some way representative of the real world, mm-hmm. in which players make meaningful decisions and those decisions affect the outcome of the game. So what is different about our games is first, we've invested significantly in storytelling and world building techniques. Mm-hmm. So there's a cinematic or novel like quality to games that we run, generally speaking. And there's a very intense media environment, including, you know, social media and news articles that are all crafted in a way where they're very realistic. There's a lot of suspension of disbelief that goes on. And what I like about our gaming practice is that it can run the gamut topically from, you know, important national security topics such as great power competition or scramble for resources in Africa to more topics that seem very much afield, such as, you know, communication challenges for Major League Baseball teams in the 2025 season. These are all games that we've run recently, often for academic institutions. And usually when we run them for any university, we'll get a lot of students coming back and saying that this was, you know, the most profound educational experience that they'd had during their university career.
Right, right. I remember you telling me that they were talking about the way they typically learn, which is very boring, and they, you know, it's hard to grasp the concepts versus being immersed in one of your games where they're fully, you know, engaged and learning while they're doing it. And it's just a very enriching experience for them.
Yeah. Or to be fair to the university, it's not so much that it's boring, but just that it's more familiar. Right. Our games tend to be very tactile and immersive, and they put you in dramaturgical roles. And then to kind of span that to other practices, there's this institution, the Global Counterterrorism Forum, which fashions toolkits that can be used by multiple governments. There are about 30 countries that are members of the Global Counterterrorism Forum, or GCTF. And they had last year a racially or ethnically motivated violent extremism series of workshops that were producing a toolkit. And they used a Valens simulation, a tabletop exercise, to anchor the conversations. Typically, at those workshops, you'll have, you know, speakers and then comments or questions after the speaker gives a presentation. Mm-hmm. And those form the basis of toolkits. And they used our game because the tabletop could make it much more democratic in the sense that many more people had an opportunity to speak wedded in this fictional scenario. And so it produced a different model for putting the toolkit together. And now with the upcoming an upcoming GCTF initiative on the same topic, racially or ethnically motivated violent extremism, but going from a toolkit to implementation, they're going to lean in, and we're now putting together what we call a gamified tabletop. So it's very much going to feel like a game. And rather than just anchoring a conversation, it actually puts people in dramaturgical roles. So to me, I like that it can span from the educational to the very practical. So that's one thing that I'm working on, which I can talk about without even worrying about breaking any confidences.
It sounds like a lot of fun and a really great way for people to learn something that's very important to their job. So it sounds like fun too. So why not have some fun, right?
Thank you. And that's why I like it. For me, you know, I work on, my team and I work on topics that are often very dark. And so I think it's important within that to figure out how to have fun within the confines of knowing that you're working on something grave. To you know, practice self-care and also care for your team. Those are all things which I think are very important when topics are often, you know, literal life and death topics.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So I want to know what you were doing right before you started this company and how this idea came to you. I mean, this is really important work. And how it came to you that, oh my gosh, I should start a company around this. Now, I'm sure the company has changed over the years, but tell us about the beginning, what your focus was, how you got the idea, how you started it. And then we'll talk some more about how you grew sales.
My background, as I mentioned, is in the national security sphere. I founded Valens in 2014. And by that time, I'd been working full-time as a subject matter expert and analyst working on terrorism issues for about a decade. And I founded Valens in large part out of frustration with the field. There'd been a couple of very wrenching debates, one of which we were in the middle of in 2014. The first one was about the impact of the regional revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa in 2011 on jihadist groups. There was this consensus in 2011 that the revolutions were going to be devastating to this movement. You can see very clearly Michael Morell writes about this in his autobiography, and you can see the New York Times reporting where, you know, basically the range of experts were saying that this was something which was devastating to Al-Qaeda, and it ended up being the opposite. I was, you know, I'd gotten the direction that the revolutions would push militant movements in, right? And it was both kind of very harmful to me, I'd say, career-wise, and also just socially within the field, I felt that there was this real propensity for groupthink that made me, you know, very uncomfortable. Then there was a similar debate with a consensus that would again prove to be wrong that I was on the outside of, you know, in opposition to in 2014, which is at the time there was this militant group, the Islamic State, which is still around and still quite well known, or ISIS, which was on the rise. And there was this consensus among experts that its rise was just going to eviscerate Al-Qaeda as a militant organization, which again, it hasn't done. One can see this very clearly in 2022, but you had the same sort of groupthink element. And I realized that both times, like, getting the questions right was not helpful to me. And I wanted to, I realized I could not change the field as an individual, but I thought maybe with a company I could do so. And I always knew from the outset that this was going to be much broader. The, you know, the, founding a company around defects in the market for subject matter expertise on a niche topic, even one that has life or death consequences, is a very, yeah, that's not a great company conception. So I always knew that it was going to be much broader because I tend to like to employ some form of lateral thinking to try to understand where the applicability is of what I'm working on to things that seem to be very far afield. So I mentioned before the sports communication game, which we just ran for Wake Forest University, which to a lot of people would seem to be very, and even to people on my team, would seems far afield from the national security simulations we've done. But to me, it's a very standard methodology. And you want to try to make the leap because it shows you that if you're able to do this for something that's as far afield from great power competition as sports communication, that there's almost an infinite number of areas where you can also make that leap. And so to me, when I started Valens, that's what I had in mind, that I'd been working on violent non-state actors and terrorist groups, but there was a broader applicability. And when I think, especially when you're working on issues that are have life or death implications, if you're doing it right, I think there's an ability to take that rigor and move it in another direction. That's what I wanted to be able to do with Valens. And I think that at this point, it's clear that we've been able to do that successfully. We work across a number of different issue areas. And for me, for my life cycle, as I'm kind of winding up my useful time as a subject matter expert and shifting really to taking my time in a CEO direction, and, you know, focusing on imparting the wisdom that I can, but trying to now position myself, growing the institutions that I think we need. I both appreciate that shift and, you know, I enjoy the last few projects I'm going to be doing as, you know, really a very hands-on subject matter expert.
Back when you started out of frustration, not unlike many of the CEOs that I know who are founders. They, you know, definitely had something that was bugging them or thought could be worked out better and started it up. So was it just you in the beginning as a consultant? What was the team like? And how did you do the sales at the very beginning?
So I was working at the time for a think tank, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, or FDD. I still have, we actually run a project for them now on domestic terrorism. And I didn't give up my day job when I started Valens. I also, my second daughter was born at the time, which made 2015 one of the worst years of my life. But I'd done consulting work in this capacity as, you know, a think tanker. I was frequently called upon to lead training, sometimes to do other interesting work, whether analytic projects or, you know, I worked on a hostage negotiation. There were lots of interesting things I was able to do in that capacity. So I understood that there was a market space there, but I didn't fully understand how big the market was. I founded Valens with a friend of mine, Cyclone Covey. He invested in it. He has no background in the field, but is a friend I'd had since college and was looking to make some investments at the time. And so he put in a modest amount of money. Originally, the team was was hiring people at more junior levels. I hired a couple of analysts who were essentially just out of college, and brought on my third employee was a senior vice president, someone who I had gotten to know when she was an intern in DC, and then who went on to do work in business development. And so I wanted to bring her in to set up business development for Valens. That's kind of the initial team. So it really initially looked like an outgrowth of the consulting work I had done before, just moving it over to an organization. And again, that's kind of to give a base of where we were starting from, with the idea being that we would scale from there and shift the methods, as of course we did.
And so who were your first clients then? Were they people that you already knew that needed consulting? You know, who were they and how did you find them?
My first client was actually a high school debate institute that was running that had a Middle East topic and brought me out to lecture there. I founded the company August 1st of 2014. And so this is just kind of how the money landed. That was the first client. I gave the money to Valens. And so that really was a high school debate institute was literally our first client. I did some good lectures for them.
Yeah.
And the second client was, it was developed by a colleague of mine, a friend of mine. It was an oil and gas company that needed to make go, no-go decisions about moving personnel through potentially dangerous areas. This included Iraqi Kurdistan. It included some parts of Africa, sometimes Saudi Arabia, areas where there were a lot of things going on that could potentially pose physical dangers, not just terrorist groups, but one of the things we were monitoring was the Ebola situation in Nigeria at the time. And so that was the second client that we had. Those were the two clients that we landed by the end of August of 2014, just barely eking out a little bit of a profit that month.
Yeah, it's great though to hear these stories, because a lot of times when founders start up their companies, they go after companies that don't know them and that they don't know, right? So it's very hard way to sell.
Yeah.
And I think as you and I talked, I'm very much a proponent of getting introductions, using your network, building your network first, right? And using that network and leveraging it. Even when you have a big sales team, as the CEO, you have this beautiful network that you can use, right? And help salespeople get these introductions and get to know people. So it's always interesting to me when companies choose to start the hard way with a list of companies that don't know them, right? And where they don't have any introductions. But so it sounds like you did it the easier way, people that you know. And so tell us a little bit about how the company grew, up to where you are today. Like what kinds of things happened next to help you grow your sales? Did you add people or process to help grow sales and bring us up to where you are now?
Yeah. So in 2015, I mentioned that is the worst year. It's perhaps the worst year of my life.
You better explain that, because that sounded pretty bad.
Well, part of it was just like the stupid timing of like founding my company and not knowing how much work that was going to take.
Right.
4 months before my younger daughter was born. So I had two, little girls at home, one of them a baby, and just took on, in addition to my day job, this massive job of being CEO of a new company that needed to be fed. So in 2015, the topics I worked on were big. ISIS was big news.
Right.
From 2014 to 15, there was a 9-month period where I was on CNN something like 120 times. I remember I counted it. So often my day would begin, at around 3 a.m. This is back before COVID. So going to being on TV, I wasn't just
studio.
Doing it from Skype,
yeah.
Right? So I had wake up at 3 a.m., get dressed, brush up on whatever was going on that day in terms of ISIS. You know, the car would come, car service would come, take me to the studio. You know, sitting around, going on air, going back to take my daughter into daycare, then running into the office and having stuff for Valens. There was just it was just this heavy pace of life, which I think I pulled something 15 to 20 all-nighters that year, which is a terrible way to work, especially when you're in your 30s, as I was then in my late 30s. So we were running out of money all the time, right? Like we staffed up too much and our sales were not covering our costs. So my friend Cyclin, who I mentioned, had to keep making loans to the company and was threatening to cut us off and we'd have to lay off staff. And and we didn't have to lay anybody off that year, but like it took a lot of work. Yeah. And then finally, you know, 2016 came and suddenly things started coming through. You know, we made some decent sales in 2015, but 2016, suddenly we were landing, you know, one project after the next. And, you know, in terms of what changed between them, I think part of it is just seeds that we'd planted starting to bear fruit. Some of it is just the, you know, luck that we kind of lucked our way into figuring things out. But as we talked about, Alice, in our offline conversation, sales have always been not just a problem for my company, but talking to other CEOs, I recognize that it's a problem in my industry. For a lot of comparably sized companies, a lot of the sales are very CEO driven. And let me be clear, at this point, I wouldn't describe Valens as having CEO driven sales, but I would describe it as having rainmaker driven sales. And I'll explain that. Yes. So we've had a fluctuating sales team in terms of size. And the two problems with sales are these. Problem one, every transaction other than war games, which would come later, but every transaction other than those is a complex commercial transaction. Mm-hmm. And you don't have a cookie cutter model for complex commercial transactions.
Right.
Second problem is that in my industry, you know, people are usually interested in national security and international affairs because they're substantively interested. There aren't that many people coming into the field who really want to do sales or business development in this particular sphere. And so we often had the problem that people who were part of our sales team really wanted to be analysts. And so they wouldn't have the devotion to really learning the art of sales, because sales is an art just like anything else. And for me, with my background as a subject matter expert, I recognized that there were two things I really needed to spend time and learn about that I didn't know based on my background. Mm-hmm. And one of them was the art of being a CEO, but the other one was the art of sales. And I realized that a lot of what I thought I knew about sales was entirely backwards. Yeah. You know, and we can get into that, but first I want to kind of round off what my model was. Yeah. So we had sales teams of fluctuating size. But what I realized is that given how it's kind of developing the relationships and having the credibility and being able to see the problem and being able to offer, you know, the solution that the client understands they need to have, that actually is something that right now people I know who are a little bit more senior are better at. So we've moved to a rainmaker model. And he's up on my website. His name is Derek Jones. He's my vice president and like one of the most brilliant people I know. I got to know him back when he's a retired full bird colonel. He'd been a Green Beret. I got to know him at a conference that U.S. Special Operations Command was holding down in Tampa back in, I think, 2009. And I realized then that like this person's something special. He's someone who I really hope I get a chance to work with one day. And I got the opportunity to hire him as he retired. And you know, just as with me, it took a little while for everything to click, for the relationships that you've been putting in place to start to yield sales. But that's happened this year. And you know, we're at a point as in a company where Derek, where a lot of sales I've been working on have been coming through at the same time that Derek has made some really big sales. Yeah. And so there's a little bit, you know, this will be ironed itself out within 2 weeks of the interview. But right now there's a little bit of chaos because we've just gotten big wins and people feel like it's very chaotic because a lot of things haven't been fully explained yet. And we have to shift some personnel around a little bit to make sure that we're able to cover the new work that we brought in. Sure. But like it's a point where the rate maker model is working, and it's working well enough that we're going to get to refocus on building up a sales team, but doing so, I think, in a little bit more of a methodical way. There's a lot of things we'll have to do to make it successful within this industry. But we went from one model, which is the sales team model, to more of a rainmaker model. And as you said at the very beginning of our conversation, now Valens is shifting to, again, building up a sales team, but in a slightly different way.
Yeah. And what I really appreciate about you is that you don't come from a sales background. You're more of an analyst, problem solver, think tank, right? Kind of guy who's looking at complex problems and figuring out how to solve them. And you took that same approach to how am I going to be a CEO and how am I going to sell? How, you know, what do I need to learn about these things so that I can be really good at them? And then you tried some things, right? And it came to you that, oh, this works this way and maybe this doesn't work. And so you've come around to a place where you're like, okay, this rainmaker model will work. And you know from our prior conversations that I believe that the CEO will always have a role in sales, but yeah, that role changes as the company matures.
Yeah.
And that one of the biggest mistakes that CEOs make is completely letting go of sales. You know, they still may keep in touch with some of the big customers, but they really aren't involved in sales and they get too far away from the way the customer wants to buy and what the customer's problems are, because they have a sales leader and a sales team to take care of that, right? Yeah. And you and I both agreed that that really was not a way to, you know, improve your sales or to be very sustainable. But I want to you to share a bit more with our audience about what this rainmaker model looks like, because I, as we, you know, talked about a little bit ago and previously, I believe in building a network, right?
Yeah.
I believe in using and leveraging that network rather than doing sales the hard way, which is calling on people who don't know you,
yeah,
right? You have no introduction. And so building a model where people are using their connections and interacting, and where when we meet with people, we're solving instead of selling, right? Because really solving is selling. When we can solve, then people can see, oh, I need to purchase because I need this solution, right? Yeah. So talk about how you're putting this all into play.
Yeah, that's a really well-framed question, or set of statements with questions in them. And it both does a good job of pointing to where we are and also where we're going. So, but in a prior life, before going into the field, which I'm known for, the counterterrorism field, I spent a very short time as a commercial litigator. And I worked for this law firm called Boies, Schiller & Flexner. David Boies, who's the first name partner, is very well known. I was working for them, I litigated for them from, I think, 03 to 04. So just before making the leap into my field, but I kind of served there as a law clerk back in 2001. And so David Boies was probably the most famous attorney in the country at the time. He'd been Al Gore's attorney in the Bush v. Gore litigation before the Supreme Court. And I got to be, I got a lot of opportunities as a young associate there. I got to be second seat to David Boies on two different arguments, and got lots of other opportunity to set foot in a courtroom or to be the lead author of briefs. And being that close to both of David Boies himself and also other partners, I got to see the sales model that law firms used. And it really is a rainmaker model where mm-hmm. there'll be some high-powered partners who are able to forge the connection and gain the confidence of clients. And as you said, show that they are best positioned to solve the point of pain that the client has. And it's the exact same thing, but with kind of a different impetus for what I do. Some things kind of speak for themselves. When it's, a physical security problem and one is looking for a solution to a physical security problem.
Yeah.
Other problems, it's a little bit different in that there'll be a complex problem someone has. You mentioned the DHS strategic framework that I was the lead drafter of back in 2019, working very closely with Elizabeth Newman, who was the Assistant Secretary for Policy, and just had a wonderful time working with her. But the then Acting Secretary, Kevin McAleenan, asked for me and for Valens Global by name, in part because, yeah. You know, 2019, utter political chaos. And you'd had a couple of domestic terrorist attacks mm-hmm. recently. This is August of 2019. Yeah. At the very beginning of the month, there was this awful attack in El Paso where over 30 people were gunned down in a Walmart. And, you know, and Secretary McAleenan realized that he wanted a strategy because the face of terrorism was changing. And we can see that clearly now in 2022. And there was no document encoding those changes and detailing how DHS could respond. Because, you know, for a department to be effective when part of its mission is a counterterrorism mission, you have to analyze the problem correctly. And you need to apply your tools in a way where it can, where it clearly delineates how they can be employed against this shifting problem. So he asked for us by name, for me by name, for Valens by name, because given the political chaos, his calculation was he needed the strategy done in 3.5 weeks, which for a strategy, I mean, that's unheard of. Basically, it's not just writing it. You have to, like, you outline it, brief the outline to the secretary, then interview every office and component. There are 22 for DHS to understand their equities. Then you draft it. Then there is a process where offices and components submit comments. There's the ESEC or executive secretary process where all comments are adjudicated. There's an interagency process. Our factual assertions are vetted by INA or intelligence and analysis. And then finally, it's submitted to the secretary for his signature. But like those are, there's about 10 steps that go into that.
Sure. Yeah.
And so he was told basically that this couldn't be done. I remember going into his office and just being surrounded by people who expected me to fail. And you know, by the end of the first conversation, I was starting to win over some of their confidence. So to get to kind of to turn to the question about sales and how does a Rainmaker model work? This was a model where basically I had to show that we could provide a solution here. We hadn't written a strategy before, but I knew based on, again, lateral thinking, I knew based on what we had done before and how we'd structured the team that I could do it. And by the end of the conversation, I was able to say, yeah, we can do this. What I'll do is I'll start half my team on the outline and half the team will start working on drafting sections that they know we'll be in. We'll do it in a modular way. The modules will be submitted for peer review as quickly as possible so the offices and components can start to comment on them. You know, things like that where I had a basic mental frame for how it could be done. Ultimately, the mental frame worked. But for clients of the network, that's exactly what you need to do. You have to understand their problem. And like it's really by listening, not just by coming in and saying something brilliant. Like you need to listen to people. And you know, you need to take on things you can solve and you can stretch. I'm big on stretching, but you can't fail on something big. You have to make sure that if you're stretching, you know how to succeed. And to me, that's how for Valens, we're able to make the Rainmaker model work right now, which is, you know, you need a good company. You need a good set of capabilities. You need to be able to solve people's problems. Mm-hmm. Now, bridging from that to where we're going, I mentioned at the outset that in my field, people want to be analysts. They don't want to be in sales. Yeah. Sales has a bad name. But as you and I talked about, as you just articulated so well, Alice, and as you and I talked about prior to this conversation, like what you're doing when you do sales is you're figuring out how do I solve someone's problems?
Right.
And to me, that is so much more interesting than actually implementing those solutions. I love solving problems. And to me, that's what the sales team needs to be. We need to shift the culture of sales. So it's not just sell, 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 or where people understand the magic of what they're doing. Because really sales to me is magical. It's understanding how to solve someone's problem and connecting them with the right solution. And it might be you and it might be someone else, but you're a problem solver.
I love that. Sales is magical. That's exactly how I feel about it. And you also said understanding their problem and then connecting them with a solution. And sometimes that's not you. Sometimes you're going to introduce them to somebody else. And if all salespeople were given permission to sell this way and supported to sell this way, I think the world would be a better place in many ways. And the economy is forcing a change. COVID forced some changes, and the buyers are changing their behavior so rapidly that if we don't start to meet the buyers where they are and help them understand their problems and the complexities and collaborate on the solutions together, you know, then these companies with these complex offerings are just not going to get anywhere. I mean, they're already struggling. They're already struggling just to simply have conversations with people whose problems they could solve.
Yeah.
And if we used our networks better and differently, right, then we could have a lot more of those conversations because we're having them to solve, not to sell. So if we have enough of those conversations to solve, eventually some of those people will need our solution and we'll have, you know, plenty of sales.
Yeah, that's precisely correct. And I had mentioned this book to you in our first call, but Jeb Blount's book, Sales EQ,
yeah,
or Emotional Quotient, it's the best book I've read about sales, because it made me think about sales in a different way and made me think about people who are trying to sell to me in a different way.
Right.
The point of the book is that it's exactly what you're saying, that the way to make a sale is by not trying to make the sale.
Right.
Right. The people who jump too quickly to, you know, offer a proposal or who say, oh, we can do that. It's always a mistake because they're not listening. Right. If you jump at the first thing a client says and say, oh, we can do that, you're not actually hearing the client's full problem.
Right.
Instead, start a relationship, have a conversation. And for me at this point, most of the sales we make are automatic, right? Like we get to know people, and when something comes that we can solve, obviously they're going to us. We don't have to struggle to make sales. Most sales that we're making, you know, other than sales we're making through submitting, you know, answering RFPs for the government, which are always like a laborious and awful process. But other than that, like most of them are sales that we're able to make automatically because the relationships are in place, our capabilities are known, and we're not kind of rushing to sell all the time. Instead, the client understands that we're there when they need us, and we're going to come through for them, and we're not going to stretch what we're able to do.
Well, it's much more of a long game. And keeping in touch with the types of agencies and companies that can buy from you, like you said, you know, they know we're here because we keep in touch with them and we help them solve when they have a question or want to noodle through something. They know they can call you and do that. And then some of that turns into business for you.
Yeah.
And if all of the analysts, you know, get that that idea that sales is yucky out of their head, right? And that sales is problem solving, then they can participate in that and just have conversations. That's the most important thing we can do today is have conversations with people who have these complex types of problems that we can solve and listen and learn and collaborate on it and see how, you know, see how we can help, right? And it's just an amazing way. And it's so much fun. Like you said, you know, digging into those complex problems for you is more fun than actually deploying the solution.
Yeah. And, you know, to be fair to everyone who thinks they want to be involved in deploying the solution instead, you know, it took me a career of deploying the solutions to come to the conclusion that at this point in my career, what I like is forging the frameworks. And I think I'm good at forging the frameworks in part because I understand what it's like to forge a solution. So I understand where people are on this, but like, so the two things we're going to do, and I'll probably give new members of the sales team a link to this interview to introduce them to our philosophy as we kind of work to rebuild our sales team. Mm-hmm. But as you said, a culture of sales on the analysis side is one facet of it. And the other one is just making the sales side itself magical, because I think that it should be. Yeah. And it's really just a matter of ingraining that culturally and make sure that you're living it. And as we do that, it will create the sales team that we really need as a company.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Now, I am just dying to ask you this question before we go. How did you get to be an expert in terrorism and nation state actors and all these things? Like, what was it that led to this? You were obviously, you know, went to law school, worked at a law firm, but how did you get into this specialty?
There is a much longer story, which is publicly available and that I've just gotten so tired of telling. So I'll tell the much shorter version. Just kind of caveat that there's a much more interesting version, that it's been a few years since I've told in full. But basically, I'd had some background in this area prior to starting law school. I went to law school at NYU, New York University. I was living in the Mercer dormitory just off of Mercer Street in West Greenwich Village. So I had a clear line of sight from my dorm to the World Trade Center, right? At night, if maybe you've had a little bit too much to drink, you'd kind of use, this is back before every phone had a GPS, you'd use the World Trade Center as like an anchor to navigate your way back to your dorm. And, I was a third year law student on September the 11th, 2001, and just felt called by this field. And so I had a really, I had a career waiting for me in law that would have been a much more lucrative career than the one that I ended up choosing. But that wasn't the point. A law degree is not, as I said, there's from studies and other things as an undergraduate and thereafter, I had a bit of a background here, but a law degree is just not easily transferable. And so I had to basically start from scratch and figure out how to forge my own career, how to forge the career I was interested in. And, I think perhaps we talked about some of the lucky breaks early in Valens' life cycle, but probably the luckiest breaks came as I was making my break in as a subject matter expert and an analyst, because I think that, at the time it was, working on counterterrorism issues was just the top of a lot of people's minds. It was a field where there's really high demand to enter, and I was able to, rise through the ranks relatively quickly. And, by the time I founded Valens, which is just a decade after I had entered the field, I was very well established as an analyst, even if things like the Arab Spring or the Al-Qaeda ISIS competition were hurting me professionally. The reason why I was in a position to be hurt was because I had a nice career already. I was very well established.
Gotcha.
I got a PhD in world politics from the Catholic University of America. I had done a variety of work as a subject matter expert. So I think that I'd say that the way that I built my expertise was basically by doing it, by taking some financial risks and putting in a lot of time. And then things somehow came together, and I'm glad that they did.
Yeah. Gosh, thank you so much, David, for being on the show with me today. I know that our listeners got a lot out of it, and it is a topic that many people are interested in and know very little bit about, but we all know that, there are terrorists out there. We all know there's security issues, physical security, as well as cybersecurity, but most of us just really don't know that much about it. So it's really interesting to hear some of these things, and especially about what you call the war games and how those help the learners who have to navigate these complex issues to learn all the different ways that they can do that. I mean, that is absolutely fascinating. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Alice. It was absolutely a pleasure. And for how much I find kind of the substance of my field interesting, I actually find kind of conversations like this about the business of the business to be most interesting, because to me, being able to build an institution like Valens and to grow an institution like Valens, that to me, much more than any single project I've worked on, is my lasting legacy. And that's what I care about right now. So I just absolutely love the conversation. And I know that we'll be in touch.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for tuning in to Sales Talk for CEOs. You can find me at alicehyman.com. Be sure and connect with me on LinkedIn and let me know that you heard the show. If you found value in today's episode, please subscribe, write a review, and share the show with another CEO.